Welcome to Time to Talk, Science and Medicine. This podcast is brought to you by the Translational Institute of Medicine at Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario. My name's Dr. Charlie Highmarch, and I'm an assistant professor and researcher at Queen's.
And my name is Stephen Archer. I'm a cardiologist and researcher, and I'm also the director of the Translational Institute of Medicine, which we call TIME.
In this series, we're fortunate to talk science and medicine with some of the most accomplished translational researchers from Queen's University and beyond. We want to know what their dangerous idea is, which is a concept that they're working on, which, if true, would change the direction of research or alter our understanding of medicine. But we also want to find out a little bit about the person behind the discoveries. In previous podcasts, we sat down with clinicians and basic scientists from Queen's University and beyond to discuss a diverse range of topics ranging from cancer research to studies of cardiovascular disease, bleeding disorder, and the impact of animal care on human and animal well-being. We've even discussed particle physics with a Nobel laureate and healthcare reform with a former dean.
Today, we're very excited to have my friend and colleague, Dr. Chris Booth, here. Dr. Booth is a medical oncologist, cancer specialist. He's a professor at Queen's University, and he holds a Canada Research Chair in Population Cancer Care. He's recently published an article, which is the result of over two decades of work. So this is one of these overnight successes that just happened after two decades of toiling in obscurity. And it's going to change the way we manage patients with colon cancer. And I suspect we're going to find out his new prescription for exercise may change cancer care in general. So it's very exciting to have Chris on the podcast today. And before we get going on your science, which is fascinating, we'd like to hear about how did you become Chris Booth, oncologist and researcher? Like, how did you start? What is your origin story?
Great. Well, thanks, Stephen and Charlie, for having me on the podcast. I grew up in Waterloo, Ontario, and I was the son of a physician and a high school science teacher. And I had an interest in medicine for a long time growing up. I also had an interest in long distance running. I also got that from my dad. So I ran quite a bit. I played soccer and other sports. My main sport was track and cross country distance running through middle school, high school. And then I came to Queen's. I ran varsity cross country and track here, studied biology and history for 3 years, and then stayed here and did medical school. During medical school, I knew pretty early I wanted to be an internist. I didn't know what area of internal medicine. I loved all of it. And so I went off to the University of Toronto, where I did my internal medicine residency, and then eventually decided to become an oncologist and did my oncology training as well in Toronto, mostly at Princess Margaret Hospital. And at the end of that, I came back to Kingston to be a research fellow at the Canadian Cancer Trials Group, which is one of the jewels of the Canadian cancer research system. Around the world, there are a number of cooperative academic trials groups that run large practice-changing trials, and Canada has one of them, the CCTG, which happens to be based here at Queen's, and it coordinates trials all over Canada and, in fact, in many parts of the world. So I came here for a two-year fellowship to learn the intricacies about RCT methods and implementation, and after a couple of years of that, I decided to stay here on faculty. I've been here ever since.
That's a fantastic story and, like a good background to getting here. I'm always interested in the transition from undergraduate to medicine. And you said biology and history. So where did biology and history come about? I mean, you've obviously grew up in an environment that was heavily sort of focused towards medicine, but the history is kind of an interesting twist. Can you tell us about that?
I love reading, and my father was an avid reader and also kind of an amateur student of history and instilled a love of history in me. And my parents were kind of avid travelers, and we traveled extensively as a family, and a big part of those trips would be to sit down. Kids would have to read a number of articles in National Geographic and do some research about where we were going. So I had a fascination of history for a long time. And I knew I wanted to go into medicine, but I also loved teaching. And so something else I thought about was being a history teacher or a history professor. And I also had, I can't remember if I got this advice from my parents or someone else, but I wasn't overly interested in studying too much medical sciences as an undergrad because I didn't want to have to repeat everything in medical school. So I was interested in studying different stuff. So I did enough of my basic science prerequisites so that I could apply to medical school. But I took quite a few history courses, which I really enjoyed. And I credit that with learning how to write. And I didn't know at the time that a lot of my career would be spent writing and reviewing and thinking critically. And I tell every undergraduate student now that comes to me for advice about wanting to go to medicine, my advice to them is take as many courses in the humanities as you can, because that's where you learn to think critically and how to write. And those are skills that will be invaluable in any career in the future.
Yeah, it's certainly true. I often, in my clinic, say to patients or to trainees that are with me in clinic that man is a giddy thing, which is a Shakespeare quote, but it's a reminder that we all are sort of humans and very sort of have many foibles and quirks. And understanding that as a physician is the key to actually being able to interact with your patient, and one of the keys to being able to interact with patients in the clinic. Well, before we go on to hear about your big discovery, I'm just thinking about how many miles you must have run before you got to the point where you did a study on exercise. And maybe at the end of the podcast, we can count up how many miles you personally ran versus how many miles you prescribed for your patients to run. I'll let you do the mental math while you're thinking of other questions.
Yeah.
Okay, so on this show, and regulars will understand, we like to ask our researchers about their dangerous idea. And this really is us asking how your idea is going to disrupt the field of study. Can you tell our audience about your current research and how it's going to change the way we think about colon cancer treatment and therapeutics and possibly other cancer treatments?
Yeah, so the CHALLENGE trial, its formal name is the Canadian Cancer Trials Group CO21 trial, was a phase 3 randomized trial. It was the first RCT in the world that was designed specifically to answer the question whether exercise can improve cancer survival.
So I'm just going to interrupt you there. Phase 3, tell us what that is in along the kind
it's
of thread.
One more than phase 2, Charlie.
Thank you very much, Dr. Archer.
I thought I'd just help the guests.
There we go.
Can you add to that?
Yeah, so a phase 3 trial means it's randomized. And so it means that half of the patients in the trial got standard of care, and half of them got a new form of treatment. And maybe I'll circle back to kind of what that looks like, and I'll tell a bit of the backstory to how we got to that idea. So the backstory to this study is quite interesting. It dates back to, as I mentioned, when I was a research fellow in 2007. I was a young oncologist. I was a former varsity distance runner, so I had interest both in cancer and trials and physical activity. And there was a pair of studies that came out in some major journals in 2005, 2006. They were observational studies using data from the Physician Health Study and Nurses Health Study in the U.S. And there was a pretty strong and consistent signal that the exercise habits of patients after their cancer diagnosis was associated with reduced cancer mortality. But these were observational data. They were not controlled. It was not an experiment. And of course, there are many things that are different from patients who exercise regularly from people who do not. And so the difference in cancer survival remained unclear. Is that being driven by their exercise habits or other things that were unmeasured in that study? So I remember distinctly reading as a young, naive, and impressionable fellow, one of the editorials saying, this is compelling data, but someone needs to run an RCT to prove it. So around the same time, I had kind of two moments in my career that kind of stood out. The first was I sat in one of the CCTG semi-annual investigator meetings. I was in a dark room. I think it was a conference room in a hotel near the Montreal airport. And there was discussions about running a clinical trial of exercise to see if it could improve chemotherapy-related fatigue. Which is a major problem for our patients. And of course, there was a lot of interest in trying to improve that symptom. And I remember listening to that proposal, and there was general enthusiasm in testing this novel form of cancer therapy to improve fatigue. But I raised my hand near the end of the discussion and said, this is great. I think we should run this study. My suspicion is it will work. It'll be positive and people will feel better with the exercise. But I'm not convinced that will change practice, policy, and guidelines. And I said, a few months ago, these two papers, and I had them in my hand, were published suggesting that we could perhaps aim much higher. And maybe we should be doing an RCT, not just to improve fatigue, but actually to change cancer survival. And I know that many very senior and thoughtful people in the room probably raised their eyebrows and thought, who is this kind of, crazy young oncologist? Because this is 20 years ago now. This was an idea way out of left field. But at the time, I had a graduate course. I was taking in epidemiology. There was no exam or midterm. There was just one course assignment. You had to write a protocol for a phase 3 randomized trial. And so I used this idea, and I partnered very early on with the leading thinker in Canada, if not globally, in the exercise science cancer space, Professor Carrie Cournier, who is a kinesiologist by training and a behavioral scientist at the University of Alberta, who for decades had been running smaller studies but also randomized trials, working with people who had cancer to change their exercise habits and their lifestyle, and had very successfully shown that with the right behavior change approach, exercise levels improve, fatigue would improve, quality of life would improve, et cetera. So I partnered with Kerry very early on, and we started writing this protocol, which I submitted for my graduate course. And I can't remember what mark I got, but I passed the course. And then I started pitching the study. And so we had meetings, the leadership of the CCTG. We get together every 6 months to consider new concepts. And we pitched it, I think, two or three times. And eventually the leadership said, okay, let's do it.
Interesting. But why colon cancer? I mean, you got this, there's so many, I mean, is the recurrence rate higher in colon cancer or why? Because your study, just to make it clear, your study is to people have the cancer, it's been treated, and you're trying to prevent it from coming back.
Exactly.
The idea. So why would you pick colon cancer? What about that disease?
Yeah. So it was the two primary bodies of literature at the time were in breast cancer and colon cancer. We probably could have chosen either. We chose colon cancer, I suspect, for two reasons. Number one, I was a young GI medical oncologist, so I was treating colon cancer. Also, the relapse rate was higher, which means that we would get an answer sooner and probably have a smaller trial than having a very, very large study in breast cancer. Since that time, you know, 20 years ago, a whole host of other observational studies in other cancers have emerged, suggesting potential anti-cancer effects in other cancers, as well as translational data supporting a number of different mechanisms by which exercise can have anti-cancer effects. So it was a bit of serendipity, and the literature was probably most mature in colon cancer at that time.
I see.
So in an effort to kind of demystify the clinical trials process, I think a lot of members of the public might go, oh, great, exercise is kind of important. We've been told that for a really long time. Why can't you just tell patients to exercise? Why do you need to go through the ordeal of having this big randomized controlled trial? Why is that necessary?
It's a great question, Charlie. And that was the one I got most commonly by friends and colleagues when I told them about this kind of crazy idea that I was working on as a fellow. And so before I get to that, just backing up a little bit, because Stephen kind of reminded me, just for listeners. So the clinical landscape here, colon cancer is a very common cancer. When someone gets diagnosed, if it has not spread beyond the bowel, then they're treated with curative intent. If it's spread beyond the bowel, they generally receive chemotherapy, but it cannot be cured. But most patients, it's diagnosed when it's curable. They have surgery first, and then they recover for a month or two. And then they get a course of what we call adjuvant chemotherapy between 3 and 6 months to reduce the risk of the cancer coming back. Despite that, we know that about 30 or 40% of patients ultimately will relapse. And usually when they relapse, their disease is not curable. So there is an unmet need in a space where we are very interested to try to improve outcomes. So you're right. We've known for many years that exercise is helpful probably in a number of different health domains and psychosocial wellness and overall emotional well-being. And so people always say, Chris, why are you going to take 10 years and millions of dollars? Of course, it took 20 years and probably a few more million dollars. To answer this question, just tell people to exercise. And our answer at the time was, you're right, people in general know they should exercise, but many people don't because it can be very hard to change a lifestyle and sustain it. And so what we want to do is run this study, because if we can show that exercise delivered through a structured program using behavior change techniques can change exercise levels and improve cancer survival, then you could embed this in models of care and go to policymakers, funders, ministries of health and say, this is considered part of the cancer system, and patients should be provided with this personal trainer support to actually enable the change.
And that leads me to ask, so it sounds like your intervention is more than just a pat on the back and a pair of Nikes and saying, get moving. So just tell us, so you get randomized to what versus what in your study?
Great question. So it was patients that had surgery and chemotherapy. They then were randomized to the control group, which received a booklet, a health education material booklet that we made that involved some general recommendations about diet, lifestyle, and exercise. Okay, so encouraging them to have a healthy diet and exercise. Or the experimental group, they got the same booklet, as well as a funded personal trainer, physical activity consultant for 3 years. And I'll talk about what that physical activity consultant did and the intervention in a moment, but it was really important to give both groups that informational booklet, because if the control group got nothing and the experimental arm got a funded personal trainer for 3 years, we wouldn't really know, was it the behavior support intervention or just someone saying, hey, you should go exercise. But both groups got the booklet. They were both empowered to go exercise. So what was different was the intervention group got this physical activity consultant. And this was, depending on the center, it was either a physiotherapist, a kinesiologist, a personal trainer who'd undertaken some specific training sessions that we ran for this trial using behavior change theories to motivate the patient to change their exercise levels. So they came up with an exercise prescription. The target, so this was delivered over 3 years, the target was for them to increase their exercise levels by something called 10 metabolic hours per week. So what's a MET, M-E-T? A MET is a unit of energy, and all of us in the next hour sitting around will expend one MET. But exercise-related METs, there's all sorts of different tables that tell you how many minutes of different intensities get you how many METs. So if we walk outside and go for a vigorous walk for an hour along the shores of Lake Ontario, that would account for 4 MET hours. And so depending on whether you're biking, swimming, running, jogging, or walking, there's these guidelines that allow a prescription to be made. We had everything in our study. Patients, some of them kayaked, cross-country skied, they did swimming, they did biking, but most of them went on a walking program. And the typical patient could hit their target if they went for a walk between 45 and 60 minutes in length at a pace where they were huffing and puffing 3 to 4 times per week. So certainly a commitment, but they didn't need to train for a marathon or a triathlon or anything like that.
It's interesting because that's sort of the guidelines that as a cardiologist that we're giving our patients for both primary and secondary prevention of cardiovascular disease, which is the equivalent of 5 days a week, 30 minutes, 40
exactly.
minutes. And so
yep.
It's sort of similar. Is this over and above their baseline, though?
Or? Yeah, so it's a delta. Now, most patients were not doing very much. So it was a delta. So for some people, they had to increase it. People who were already doing high-level exercise were excluded from the trial.
I see.
There was not very many of them.
Yeah.
And on the other end, people had to be fit enough to walk on a treadmill for 6 minutes, but they'd already had a pretty good stress test. They'd had a hemicolectomy mm-hmm. and 6 months of chemo. So it was very uncommon for someone to be frail enough that they couldn't participate in the study.
And we always, in clinical trials, we always talk about the people you don't study. So just big brush strokes, like of all the people that could have been in the trial, how many people were excluded because of some criteria like couldn't exercise, wouldn't exercise, or were elite?
Yeah, so the external generalizability of this trial is something we'll talk about later. I would say very few patients were excluded, but a lot of patients weren't interested. Okay. And so certainly the patients that we know in general that go on clinical trials tend to be very motivated. They often are younger with less comorbidity. And, you know, this was a pretty unique trial. People had already been in the system for a year by the time they had their GI bleed and their scope and surgery and recover and all that. And this was an added request plus exercise. So it did take a specific phenotype of person to volunteer to sign up for this. So that's important. Maybe we'll talk about that a bit later, about the policy and the translation of this into routine practice, which is something that we'll have to put some thought into. But just very briefly to finish off the intervention. So this behavior change program was delivered every 2 weeks for the first year. And those sessions were about an hour long or so every couple of weeks. They would start with a meeting, kind of a motivational goal-setting meeting, reviewing the prescription, making a plan for the next week using these behavior change techniques. And the second half of the session would be supervised exercise, either on a treadmill or an exercise bike. And that happened every 2 weeks for the first year. And then in year two and year three, it was about maintaining that with these monthly check-ins. It would be a monthly kind of touch point with the physical activity consultant. We did that for 3 years. And the primary endpoint was disease-free survival, which is a composite endpoint of recurrence, new cancer, and death.
So obviously, I think that, you know, the main headline here is kind of survival. And that's obviously what we're really focused on. And on this podcast, we don't do gotchas, but I want to imagine that our audience will also be thinking economically about the price of a personal trainer. And I bet you've incorporated some of this into your thinking, too. Do you think it's less expensive to treat remission with personal trainers than it is with conventional therapeutics?
So we have a formal cost-effectiveness analysis underway, but just for the audience to have some context, the typical new cancer drug costs between $100,000 and $200,000 per year. And, you know, the exercise program involved meeting with an exercise specialist twice a month for a year and then monthly after. So the back of the envelope calculations, when you put an hourly rate in for a personal trainer, comes up to about $4,000 over 3 years. So suffice it to say, this is a pretty low budget intervention in the grand scheme of things.
It's interesting. I'm sure if we could interact with the people that are listening to this podcast, they're probably thinking, I wonder how much effect you could possibly get by just having someone do a couple of hours of exercise a week, even admittedly with a trainer and someone's, you know, ensuring you actually did it. But, you know, it would be interesting if we could read all those thought bubbles and see, are we talking like no effect, 5% change in outcomes? But what, you know, if you jump ahead to the major headline of your study, what effect did you get from this? And we'll come back later and talk about what percent of people were compliant and everything adherent. But Was it a big effect or a small effect?
It was a very large effect. So the primary endpoint of disease-free survival, we had a 28% reduction in the risk of recurrent or new cancer.
That's huge.
And when we look at that from an absolute perspective, the rate of disease-free survival at 5 years was 74% in the control group compared to 80% in the exercise group. So another way that listeners can think of this is a number needed to treat. So for every 16 people who went on the exercise program, exercise prevented one person from developing new or recurrent cancer. And then the other major headline was the overall survival or overall mortality results. And we also had a very clinically meaningful and statistically significant improvement in overall survival, a 37% reduction in the risk of death. We had long follow-up on these patients, so the median follow-up in the trial was 8 years. And so the point estimates, the proportion of patients alive at 8 years was 83% in the control group and 90% in the exercise group. Again, a number needed to treat of 14. So for every 14 people who went on the exercise program, exercise prevented one person from dying.
And if this were a drug, of course, the next question would be, besides Charlie's question, but what is the cause? But what are the side effects? So were there side effects of exercise that you should warn your patient about?
Great question. And Dr. Archer, the athlete and cardiologist, knows there's a few side effects to anticipate. In fact, what we saw was what you might expect, a slight increase in the risk of musculoskeletal injuries associated with exercise. No strong safety signal or worrisome signal at all. And I guess just to kind of, you're right, you know, if you compare this to a drug, and when you're asking about effect size, the magnitude of benefit observed with the exercise program was comparable, in fact, in some cases exceeds many of our very good standard cancer drugs. And so I just want to be clear, I'm not suggesting exercise replaces these cancer drugs. In the clinical trial, this was added after having surgery and adjuvant chemotherapy. But if you look across a whole bunch of diseases at drugs that are given after surgery to prevent recurrence, the magnitude of benefit we saw with exercise is right in the same ballpark.
Yeah. And I think this is one of these things that on one hand, it's so simple, but on the other hand, people aren't doing it. And, you know, I suspect that most people after cancer are the last thing they're thinking of when they get that diagnosis and therapy is, I should really get my sneakers on and get out for a walk.
Yeah.
So that's...
I think the side effects obviously would go along with kind of like increased kind of mental health.
And, yes.
You know, like ability to interact with nature and all sorts of other great things.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the risk-benefit ratio of this intervention is unlike almost anything that we do in medicine, certainly anything we do in oncology. Whereas, you know, let's go back to that number needed to treat. You treat 14 people, one person's benefited and they're cured from the exercise. If this was a drug, the other 13 people would not have had a change in their cancer outcome, but they put up with a lot of side effects, hassles, and they feel pretty sick. But an exercise program, those other 13 people, they might have a little bit of sore hamstrings, but they're going to benefit from the other things that we know we saw in exercise. So just a couple of the other kind of key results. We found that there was also an improvement in the primary patient reported outcome, their quality of life, physical function improved. We found that there was also objective improvements in physiologic fitness with VO2 max and 6-minute walk test also improving.
Yeah, it is perhaps not surprising. You probably also, I would imagine, picked up some benefits by secondary prevention or primary prevention of cardiovascular diseases and other things that are not uncommon in cancer patients where the same prescription would be predicted to be beneficial. I don't know if you broke it down. You had all cause. Did you look at cardiovascular mortality?
Yeah, great question. That was the first thing I was really interested in. You know, I still remember that Friday afternoon in February at 5:30 p.m. I got the study results and essentially didn't sleep that weekend. But I was really curious to see, is the mortality benefit here from diabetes and cardiovascular disease? But in fact, it was driven by a clear reduction in the risk of colon cancer. You know, again, that was their highest risk of death was in that context was colon cancer. I think over time, it'll be very interesting to follow and to see, you know, cardiovascular diabetes benefits down the road.
So our next question, which you sort of answered, but I'll give you another shot at this type of presentation, which is if I were a high school student, so you've done this great New England Journal study, but you're trying to get the attention of someone who's like 17, 18 years old sitting in a high school classroom. So what's the punchline of your study for a high school student?
I think the punchline would be when patients finish chemotherapy, as an oncologist, the most common question they'll ask their doctor is, what else can I do? And we know that surgery and chemotherapy provide a very important amount of benefit to trying to cure or prevent this cancer from coming back. But we now have evidence that of something that's quite empowering for people, that they can be involved and take charge of their own health and work with a personal trainer to do an exercise program, which will improve their chance of surviving cancer.
Getting back to Charlie's question, you were asking like how much this all costs. Mm-hmm. And I guess there is that caveat in your study, right? I mean, this is all great, but this was not just please go exercise. This was like someone doing that. So I know the cost data are still out there, but I assume you consider that essential or you would not have designed the trial to have a coach.
Yeah.
And so does anyone in Canadian medicine get prescribed a coach in 2025?
Well, it's starting to change. So the interest in this study has exploded over the last few months. So I've had countless kind of letters and emails from, you know, patients and physicians and researchers, but also from policymakers and discussions with very senior people in ministries of health around the world. And the policy kind of translation here that we really need to push on is we can't just tell people to exercise. That's what the control arm was. We really need the system to invest in providing access to this behavior support program after someone finishes chemotherapy for colon cancer.
So I imagine that this story has received a little bit of attention outside of Queen's University and been picked up by some media outlets. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's been remarkable. So, you know, it was published the same day I presented at the big cancer meeting, the American Society of Clinical Oncology in Chicago in early June. It was published in the New England Journal of Medicine the same day. And the media explosion was phenomenal and quite frankly, overwhelming. So in the period of that week or so, it was reported as something in like 400 newspapers around the world. You know, I was doing interviews on BBC, the New York Times, CBC, you know, in newspapers in India and in almost every country around the world covered this. And I think because it captured, you know, the public's imagination, and it's also something that patients and clinicians have been interested in for quite some time, is what can we use from, you know, a lifestyle perspective to improve cancer survival?
So I imagine we're going to see some follow-ups in other disease types that are going to take this thread and try and pull on it.
Yeah. So the projects that are kind of cooking within our study are the cost-effectiveness analysis. There'll be a whole bunch of translational work that'll be coming because the participants graciously provided blood specimens at multiple time points throughout the three-year intervention. We're also very interested in exploring kind of what factors predicted adherence to the intervention and what would be the most important component of the intervention and how much exercise generates how much benefit. So there's lots of kind of work still to be done.
And not to be all sciencey on you, but do you have any guesses as to why it's beneficial? Like, not that we have to turn exercise into a pill or a drug, but was there something about this exercise regimen that we predicted to be anti-carcinogenic or anti-mitogenic?
Yeah, great question. So, the translational data over the last 20 years is pretty clear. There's likely a number of mechanisms. So you can imagine there'd be vascular effects of exercise. There will be hormonal effects. There'll be inflammatory effects and immune-mediated effects. And so a number of studies in various different cancers have shown anti-cancer properties of aerobic exercise through one of those multitude of pathways. And it's quite likely there's kind of multiple effects. So to getting to one of the earlier questions too, one of the interesting and kind of really gratifying parts of the last few months has been the next generation of oncologists and scientists in this field reaching out to talk about their ideas for where to go next. And so there's a study in ovarian cancer that we'll be reporting very soon that's been going on for many years, a study in breast cancer looking mostly at dietary intervention, but also a bit of exercise. We'll be reporting in the future as well. But, you know, I very, you know, engaged phone chat with a surgical oncology fellow in the U.S. probably about a month ago, and him and colleagues are planning a similar study in kidney cancer. So I think there'll be a whole kind of new area of exercise oncology exploding in this space.
Excellent. So I think we'll just put mitochondria down as the answer.
Yes. Yeah.
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So enough of the good news. Obviously, this has been a wild ride, and you've received enormous amounts of kind of respect and acknowledgement for your work. But every professional has a bump in the road. Maybe you can tell us about a bump in the road that you've had along the way that's got in the way of getting this work out there.
Yeah, we had a few curveballs along the way. I mean, I think one of the really key things at the beginning was what enabled the trials group to be brave enough to take this on. And I think, you know, that was not a given. And so I think it's just worth acknowledging what enabled this, which was the patient community, the advocate community, and the patient representatives of the trials group were very, very keen on supporting this. And the leadership of the trials group and the funding, which came from the King Cancer Society. So I think it's worth kind of really acknowledging those things. We had some curveballs. So, you know, the trial that I mentioned that was going to test exercise to improve fatigue at a sample size of about 200 people. And when we powered it for a survival benefit, all of a sudden the sample size was 1,000 people. So there was a few frantic weeks once it was approved, and we realized, okay, we need some partners fast. We're not going to be able to pull this off on our own in Canada. And so fortunately, one of my colleagues, who was a fellow at Princess Margaret in Toronto, just a couple of years ahead of me, Dr. Jeanette Vardy, had just returned to her native Sydney, Australia, and was junior faculty. I still remember calling her quite nervous because I knew we needed a partner very soon. And I said, Jeanette, we've got this crazy idea. We want to run this trial. You know, we need partners. Are you interested? She said, Chris, we're in. I'll write a grant. And she got, as a junior investigator, a very large grant from their equivalent of CIHR to get started. We had a few curveballs along the way. COVID was a big one, right? Because this is a face-to-face intervention. So that impacted our trial. We had to pivot and include some virtual components along the way because of that. We had some centers that would open and close. I think the biggest challenge was, as I mentioned, that patients were, they loved the idea of the study when I and my colleagues would speak to them about it during chemotherapy. But by the end of the chemotherapy program, the idea of completing more forms and doing more blood tests and more scans was really, really hard for them, especially people who wanted to get on with their lives or go back to work. So we're going to need to think about that very mindfully as we roll this out into the real world. And so, you know, what does this look like? You know, I think the model I would like is that this is funded in the public system. I can tell you people are already going to personal gyms and paying for this. And in fact, we were able to get some local funding here at the Kingston Health Sciences Center so that we can now offer this to our patients. We're partnering with the Revved Up program at the Kinesiology Group at Queen's. And so this program will now be offered in Kingston as, you know, kind of a stepping stone, hopefully, to a program funded across the province.
So you can actually provide the protocol for patients, yep, or any member of the public to follow as, yep, kind of prophylactic or as,
exactly,
a kind of therapeutic.
Yep.
Amazing.
Yeah, so it's now, cool, it's now available. I mean, the whole guidebook is in the supplement in the New England Journal of Medicine, and patients and groups are writing to us. And so we're going to have to do some kind of probably some standardized training modules, kind of virtual training to get that up and running. But I think, you know, as far as, you know, the curveball is going to be, what does this look like in the real world? Because it's probably not feasible for people to come into the cancer center. That's going to require a lot of traveling, and the expertise don't necessarily lie in the cancer center nor their exercise facilities. So we're going to have to be creative about what this looks like. Ideally, bring this closer to where people live to prevent the barriers. Does it look like a partnership with a local YMCA? Is it going to be a university gym? Is it going to be, you know, piggybacking on to cardiac rehab? You know, we have to think creatively about what this looks like.
Or even online, given that you've had to pivot at some.
Correct. Correct. Yep.
I have a great idea for you, Chris.
Yeah.
I don't need credit for it, but we do want sponsorship for,
yeah,
the podcast. So Peloton. When you get your cancer therapy, you get a Peloton subscription.
Peloton,
and it's like,
yeah,
because those people will encourage, intimidate the hell out of,
yeah,
you until you finally start exercising.
Exactly.
So we always ask our guests a crystal ball question. So I guess the crystal ball would pertain to exercise and cancer. And if exercise is good for preventing recurrence of cancer, what's the crystal ball in terms of the exercise prescription to prevent cancer, which presumably would be more important even than regressing it? Is that something you see in the future, or is it going to always be a secondary prevention measure?
Well, I think that I think the work in the next 5 years is going to explore to what extent does this apply to other cancers. I think there will be a lot of interest to figure out how can we refine, adapt, or add to this exercise program and make it even better, right? We didn't include strength training in this. Do you need the full 3 years? What element of the exercise behavior change program was most important? Some of the early data we've got right now shows that the first 6 months are crucial. You can predict someone's exercise levels at year two and year three largely based on what they're doing at the end of the 6 months. So there really needs to be a lot of support in those first 6 months. And so I think the crystal ball is going to be kind of the evolution of the science, but also what does it look like in practice? And so I hope, and I know that international guidelines are already starting to change to embed this as part of standard of care. I like to see, you know, my crystal ball, a system where, you know, someone gets diagnosed with cancer, the system provides their surgeon who does the operation, they get referred to me, and the system provides the chemotherapy, and then I can then refer them to an exercise therapist somewhere in the system that will deliver this intervention.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting.
Okay, so before we wrap this podcast up, we would like to get to know you a little bit. So we've got a few questions that are designed specifically.
Very important questions.
Very important.
All right, okay, good. High end science.
Difficult questions.
Probe your life and find out more about you. So we'll start. Stephen, maybe you ask the first one.
So we'll start off with a softball question.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite meal, Chris, and can you cook that dish yourself?
Hmm. My favorite meal, I spent a lot of time doing work in India with colleagues, kind of academic work and just traveling around. So I say a nice Indian curry, and I would not attempt to make that. I know where to find it, but I would not attempt to make it.
I think curry may have risen to our number one food.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's the most popular one?
Yeah. Of all the guests, like, yeah. It comes up probably the most often.
Yeah. I've got a lot of time for Indian food.
Yes.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Okay, so what type of music do you like? And can you play an instrument? And can you play that music on it?
Yeah, yeah. So I took classical piano for about 10 years when I was younger. I can play a little bit of piano still, not kind of high-end classical music anymore. But I am a very amateur guitar player. So I probably learned 8 or 10 guitar chords when I was 16, and I can still play those 8 or 10 guitar chords. But like anyone knows, you can play a lot of rock and roll and folk electric with about 8 or 10 guitar
chords.
So I enjoy that. Yes, exactly. So I still enjoy doing that with my kids or with friends around a campfire.
Oh, perfect.
So what's the strangest job you've ever done?
The two jobs that I did through university and even early parts of medical school, I was a wilderness guide for canoe trips in the far north for a kid's kind of canoe tripping camp. But the really strange job is what I would do for 2 months before that, which was tree planting. So I would go up to Northern Ontario, live in a tent in the snow and bugs in May, June, and plant thousands and thousands of trees in the most difficult conditions you can imagine. We got paid 8 cents a tree. But if you get good at it and you've got the kind of a long distance running kind of mindset, you can actually make a lot of money. But it's a quite a wild job.
I was actually a tree planter for 2 days. I don't know if that counts. I was also a lumberjack for 1 day.
So. In the most Canadian moment ever.
Yes, yes, that's right. Exactly.
Not good at either.
Yeah.
Okay, so I could probably foreshadow what the answer is going to be for this next one, given your educational background. But if you could time travel, would you go backwards or forwards? And if so, why?
Yeah, I'd go backwards because I often, especially around, I like spending time in nature and natural landscapes, and I often think, what would this have looked like, 100, 500, 1,000 years ago?
Oh,
and who would be the people and the cultures and the landscapes that I would encounter? So I'd go backwards.
I was going to say, Kingston at some point was underwater, under tropical seas, so you wouldn't want to go back to
Exactly.
Although it might be warmer in winter.
Yes.
So if you have one piece of advice for young people based on your own experiences, what would that piece of advice be?
I think it would be to be open to serendipity, not have the blinders on, be willing to risk and take chances, and the importance of finding thoughtful leaders and mentors that will support you and help you develop the ideas.
That's good advice. Good advice to keep open 100%. To serendipity even when you're not a young person.
Yes.
Yeah, for sure.
Yes.
Okay, the last and arguably the most important question you'll have this year, possibly, actually. If you were a cartoon character, which one would you be and why?
Well, given my athletic background, I would hope I didn't run off a cliff, but I'd be a roadrunner.
Meep, meep.
Yep.
That's right. So you never fall until you realize you're suspended in midair. And
exactly. Exactly.
Okay, Dr. Booth, on behalf of Dr. Archer and myself, I'd like to thank you today for coming in and taking time to talk to our audience about your research. And also to our listeners, I'd like to thank you for taking time to get to know Dr. Booth with us, and we hope that you enjoyed the show. If you did enjoy this episode and would like to know more about research at Queen's University, or indeed share this podcast with family and friends, you can search for Time to Talk Science and Medicine wherever you normally look for podcasts. Dr. Booth, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Chris.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show.